Welcome once again to the chat room, where we have the fastest 28 minutes on television tackling an enormous topic, and the man who does the chatting, fortunately, is not me, it's Philip Jensen.
G'day. Am I chatting or tackling today?
Tackling a really difficult subject.
Good. So,
there is a funny idea that people have about science, isn't it? Science is almost...
Science is fact.
Yes.
Whereas all Christianity, all religion, is faith. And so there's the division. And they're happy for us, provided we keep just in the faith basket.
But that misrepresents science, doesn't it?
It misrepresents science, because science is actually faith, and it misrepresents Christianity, because it's actually fact.
Yes. Science is not as solid as the scientists like to pretend it is. That's the point.
No, it can't be. Yeah. It can't be. I mean, the word science changes meaning over time. Originally, the word just meant knowledge.
Yes.
Which could be all kinds of
things. So you had natural sciences, and theology was the coin of the sciences,
yes.
All that sort of thing.
But as science has developed in the 19th century and been propagandised through the 20th century, science is fact, religion is faith. It comes out of that kind of German philosophical division between knowledge and noumenal and phenomenal, but we needn't go into it.
No. But the idea that science is fact, a few nice old quotes from some great scientists sort of explode that a bit. Lord Kelvin was a great scientist.
He was one of the greatest scientists. He was a great physicist of the late 19th century. I mean, the Kelvin scale, he was a great expert in electricity and also a great expert in thermodynamics. So, I mean, he was one of the great scientists of the late 19th, just into the 20th century.
Lovely quote here from Lord Kelvin, great scientist who said, quote, heavier than air machines are impossible. There's a great scientist speaking,
yes,
isn't it?
He said that one, I think, about 3 or 4 years before the Wright brothers flew.
Then he said, radio has no future. And then he said, I like this one, X-rays are a hoax.
Yes, that's good.
I don't know what it is we're looking at on those things, but we're looking at something. Okay, so that's a great scientist, getting things wrong. There are some lovely ones. The British Astronomer Royal, his name I'm not sure I want to try and pronounce, but the British Astronomer Royal, you would think, would know what he's talking about.
Yes.
He said in 1956, so only 50 years ago, space travel is utter bilge.
Now, what year was Sputnik? Was it 57?
I think it was a year later, yes.
Because it was around that
in
time.
In the early 60s, they were orbiting the Earth with men. Yes.
So just a year beforehand.
So the managing director of the International Monetary Fund said in 1959, in all likelihood, world inflation is over. What have our politicians been up to? They've reinvented it.
They reinvented inflation. But also, whenever you did economics or psychology, there were two of the subjects I remember doing in my youth, where the first few lectures were always about, we are a science.
Ah.
And it was like that, we think the lady
so
protests
everyone wants
too
to be
much.
A science.
Everyone wants to be a scientist, but if you've got to give lectures to demonstrate that you are, it makes you wonder as to what a science is and why economics is a science.
But, it's the dismal science. but there is this thing of science is simply not as solid, not as certain as it pretends to be.
No, it can't be. Well, in fact, pretense is the right word. It's the journalistic view of science. It's the man in the street view of science. The philosophy of science is not about fact. It's about a process. It's about an openness to evidence whereby we will change our mind. Science is a wonderful thing.
So it keeps changing and growing all the time.
It falsifies. It grows by falsifying things. So you've got 10 or 11 different theories. It knocks out all but one. It still doesn't know the one is true, but it knows all those ones are wrong. And it continues on that working hypothesis that the last one's true.
Until it gets falsified.
Until it gets falsified. And then either they say, well, we don't know, or they've come up with two or three more hypotheses. But it's a wonderful thing that it is open to reason. It's open to evidence. It's open to information.
And that's what's actually good about it.
That's what's good about it. And it's changeable.
Yes. Well, it was Sir Karl Popper, great philosopher of science, Austrian-born British philosopher of science, wrote a great book called The Logic of Scientific Discoveries, who said all scientific knowledge is either hypothetically true or definitely false. That's not the impression you get from the newspaper.
It is not. Because they don't understand the scientific... So science now is a methodology.
Yes.
It's not a body of facts. Now, this methodology has created for us a body of things that we, in normal language, would call facts.
Yes.
But everything and anything is open to challenge.
And even when they think they've got it locked down, for about 100 years or more, they thought Newtonian physics was the last word in physics. And then along came Albert Einstein, and there was a whole lot of Newtonian physics that is just wrong or inadequate.
That's right. And we're locked down on E equals MC squared. But
in 100 years, who knows?
In 100 years' time, they can come up with something completely different and show that the E equals MC squared is wrong.
But the famous story about the professor of physics lecturing the postgraduate class, and at the end of the most advanced course on physics has to say, I've got to warn you, half of what I've told you is not true.
Yes.
And I don't know which half.
Well, I had a friend who was lecturing, I won't say exactly which subject, but it was in the biological sciences, and he's a very conscientious, lovely Christian man lecturing at university in this area, an associate professor. And he told me after a few years, the first few years, he updated his lectures every year. And then after about 5 or 10 years, he worked out this is a waste of time, because whatever I've updated this year, next year I'm going to have to update again. So he said, I, from there on, in just taught what was wrong. I knew it was wrong, but there was no point teaching what I thought was right, because what I thought was right was also wrong. And so he would teach the information that was out of date, and then teach them about how out of date information is, and how they mustn't trust the results so much as the way of thinking and understanding, because that is something that you can convey to a student, whereas to teach them XYZ when in next year XYZ is all wrong, but they will carry XYZ for the next 50 years through their life,
yes,
is a big mistake. It's better to teach them, I'm teaching XYZ but don't believe it, because this is how we come to this evidence, this is how we know it, and it's all changing.
So the good thing about science is that it's open.
Yes,
the false view of science is that it's closed and it solved all the problems.
Yes.
So where does the false view come from?
Well, science has been a political toy for 150 or more years. See, there was a great science educator, Thomas Huxley, who in the 19th century used science as a tool in his conflict with the establishment education in Cambridge and Oxford. Cambridge and Oxford were the southern upper class English establishment kind of universities, as the northern part of England was the industrial, non-classical, science-driven revolutionary areas. It was also established church as against free church in that period of time. Now Huxley was trying to promote the industrial revolution in England, trying to promote science-based, evidence-based education, and was anti the classics. And so he used science to oppose the establishment. And he and a group of people created around them an unnecessary antagonism, an unnatural enmity. It wasn't helped by the Cambridge and Oxford classicists not paying too much attention to modern scientific discoveries, which they did change by the end of the 19th century. And of course, great scientific work has been done in Cambridge and Rutherford and the rest. But in the 19th century, there was resistance to this new learning that came at the universities, and or the big old universities. Now, Huxley was a very, very fierce atheist in his ways, although he invented the word agnosticism.
Yes, it's a nice cloak for his atheism, in fact.
Yes, tell me the difference, or tell us the difference between atheism and agnosticism as a wordsmith.
Agnosticism just comes from the Greek word for knowledge, and it means I don't know.
Yes.
Whereas atheist means there is no God. They've both got that negation at the beginning, and one says no God and the other one says no knowledge.
Yes, but of course, for Huxley, the no knowledge was, I really know that I can't know everything, which atheism requires, so therefore I'll say agnosticism. It was a cloak.
Yes.
Because he was using all the discoveries he could find, especially in the biological sciences, all the discoveries he could find, to raise science education in the schools, teaching university people in London rather than Cambridge, Oxford, to be science educators, and to teach science as the way over against, not just Christianity, but classical learning and the kind of upper class establishment way of thinking. Of course, for him, Darwin was a very important person, and he used Darwin. He was much more anti-religious than Darwin was.
He was described as Darwin's bulldog.
Yes, Darwin's attack dog. That's right. And at the time, the Royal Academy was the kind of the place where you established the Royal Society, established truth and error in scientific discoveries. Lord Kelvin was the president of it at one stage. But for about 10 or 12 years, the X Club, as they were called — I'm no great believer in conspiracy theories, but this is a well-documented conspiracy theory — the X Club, a group of atheists, made sure they got elected to presidents of this society so as to establish this kind of philosophy. Now, today they're still doing it. Atheists are still using science in order to promote atheism, rather than scientists have ever discovered atheism as a way. So intelligent design is not particularly Christian. It's consistent with Christianity, but it's not particularly Christian. But Christians use it to promote Christianity, and atheists abuse it to promote atheism. But the idea itself is hardly ever discussed. That's not the heart of it. So a group of scientists here in Sydney collected a petition against intelligent design. Well, scientists petitioning is a nonsense. That 3,000, that 4,000, that 50,000 scientists disbelieve something is no proof of anything.
That's not how scientific knowledge works.
That's not how scientific knowledge works. Exactly. It's the exact antithesis of science.
We'll all vote on this. No, that's not science,
folks.
That's
not science. Yes. Because the one person who shows the evidence that the theory is wrong is as powerful as the 10,000 who have believed in it.
The evidence, not the vote.
Yes. And so that scientists will vote on something indicates that we're not dealing with science.
Yes. They may be scientists, but they're not doing science.
No, they're doing prejudice at this point in time. Yes. And they're attacking religion using science rather than doing science.
They've been successful at it. Thomas Huxley and all his descendants and heirs and successors down to the present day have been quite successful. Yes. They managed to push Christianity into a box and portray Christianity as being faith-based with no evidence to support it. So that's wrong. What's the real relationship between science and Christianity? What's the truth here?
Well, it's faith is also a dodgy word. It's a difficult word. For the science, the atheistic person, faith is irrational superstition. That's where it came. Alan Isaacs wrote a book on science and Christianity, and that was his kind of definition. It was just superstition. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not ever what Christians mean by faith. Faith for us is trust. Well, you can't do science without trust. You trust your colleagues, you trust your research, you trust
your equipment.
Trust your equipment, you trust your own mind and your capacity to reason. You've got to trust. But trust doesn't have to be irrational, irrational, or anti-rational. There's reasonable trust and there's stupid trust.
Yeah, you can have well thought out, well evidenced trust.
Yeah. Yeah, and trust is always open to being misused and abused. And so I trust you and your results, but you could be fudging your results. There are many examples of scientific fraud, not just the silly ones you mentioned earlier where people don't know, but actual
deliberate fraud.
Yes.
The researcher who was doing a breeding experiment with mice and coloured them in with texture because he didn't get the results he wanted. Actually happened. I'm making it up. Yeah.
And so you trust them. However, trust is not absolute.
Yes.
So it's always open for me to repeat the experiment.
Did he really get these results?
Did he get these results? Yes. And so I can question this. Well, that's true with Christianity too. I mean, I trust that the Bible is saying, speaking the truth, when it says that Jesus lived in Galilee, that there was a place called Galilee, there was a place called Nazareth, there was a place. But I can go and check.
Mm. It's still there to look at.
It's still there to look at. Some places aren't still there, but I can look through historical records of other people who referred to these places or these times. I mean, the Bible referred to Pontius Pilate. For many years, there was no other real reference to Pontius Pilate. But then we came across other references to Pontius Pilate, and so now
Inscriptions in stone and things like that. Yes.
Which just gives the idea. Yeah. One of the King Herods died, according to the Bible, in Acts chapter 13. He just suddenly was struck down and died at a critical moment when he was claiming to be God, or allowing the people to claim he was God. And you read the account and you say, gee, that sounds unlikely. But you can find the same thing in the Greek writers as well. They recorded
the non-Christian writers.
The non-Christian writers recorded. And so you can say, well, this was a well-known public event that happened. I mean, the Bible said it happened in front of a huge crowd. Surprise, surprise. It's found in other historical documents. It must, Now, you trust, but you can check on trust. However, science builds out of testing, whereas the Bible doesn't build out of testing all the time. There is a difference. The aim of science is always to doubt and to disprove. They advance by showing things are false. Whereas Christian knowledge is human relationships. You don't advance your relationship by proving things are false.
No, it's not good for me to advance my relationship with my wife by doubting her all the time.
If you doubt her all the time, you won't have a wife.
So you build a relationship doing other things, not doubting,
That's right. However, should ever there be evidence that there is something amiss with your wife, you can go and test.
Yep.
You can go and check. You can employ a private detective agency to check. That is the case. But it's a very dangerous poison to a relationship to start checking.
So Christianity is relational based, not questioning and doubting based.
Yes.
Yes.
So there is a difference. But it's not, this is superstition and this is fact. Mm. And we have facts and no faith. No, we've got faith in our scientific methodology, which from time to time has had to be improved because we found it doesn't rule out things. We have faith in our rational connectedness of ideas. We have faith in our mathematical reasoning.
A man named Thomas Kuhn wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in which he showed that enough evidence against a universally accepted principle comes up and it has to be discarded.
Yes, yes, and the whole paradigm shifts.
Yes.
And there was that scientist, Harold Isink, who was a psychologist at London University, if I remember correctly. He held radical views, views that I personally don't like, about racial connections with intelligence. Now, when he came to Australia, he had terrible trouble. People were protesting against the running meetings, and I think some of his meetings had to be suspended. So much was the freedom of intellectual inquiry that we're not even able to talk about it. I remember reading one of his things where he said, the more certain the idea, the less people hold it passionately. The more uncertain, the more they hold it passionately. And he was sure that the evidence showed that intelligence, as we understand it, differs between different ethnic groups. Now, because of my fear of racism and my hatred of racism, I hate that idea. I don't like that idea. I don't want that information to be true, and I don't want it to be publicised if it is true. But because of my scientific inquiry, if it's true, we should find this out. If that is the case, that is the case. I mean, after all, there are not many white men going to run in the 100 metres at the Olympics. I don't expect.
So there may be different skills, who knows?
There might be different skills in different racial groups. And hey, if that's the way it is, that's the way it is. There'll be very few black men swimming in the 100 metres in the swimming pool.
That may well be in the front ranks of the marathon.
Yes. And so if we are physically different, it's possible, it's conceivable that we are intellectually different. I don't like the idea because...
And we'd have to preserve the idea of us still being of equal value before God.
Absolutely, which as Christians we can, but non-Christians have a terrible hierarchy of what's important and unimportant, and so people who can't think as well could easily be put down by those who can think as well. And testing it would be very difficult because the tests could be so culturally biased and so on. But it's interesting, Isink's idea that what we can't know too well, people hold passionately to.
And it makes you worry about the people who are really passionate about certain scientific theories, for example. Now, talking about the real relationship between science and Christianity, a mutual friend of ours, Dr. Kirsten Burkett, has written a terrific book called Unnatural Enemies.
Yes.
You'll recognise it because the cover looks exactly like this. You should buy a copy. It's a very good book.
It is. Now, she did a PhD in the history and philosophy of science.
Yes.
She now lectures in a theological seminary.
Right. So she sees how they connect.
She sees how they connect. And the book title, I mean, I don't want to give away the book message because you really need to read the book. It's a good book to read. But the book title says it all. These are unnatural enemies. And enmity has been set up between science and Christianity, but it's completely unnatural because it's out of Christian history that science as we know it has developed.
We've actually given birth to science.
Yes. Hinduism wouldn't. Yes. Buddhism wouldn't. Atheism hasn't. It's Christianity that has given rise to it. And a lot of the great breakthroughs in scientific discovery of the 19th century were done by English clergymen. The clergymen who attacked evolution, so-called, in the great Oxford debate, had a degree in science, whereas the great evolutionist had a degree in theology.
Yes.
So 19th century education.
The separation is not a real separation, and it's not that deep.
No.
In the end, this kind of discussion boils down to how we know we know, where our knowledge comes from, our sources of knowledge come from. And there's only a few possible sources of knowledge, aren't there?
Yes. One is deduction.
We reason it through. This leads to this, leads to this, leads to this.
And we use deduction a lot. But deduction knows nothing. Deduction is a mental process like chess or like drafts or like the rules of any game. We make up rules and we say mathematics is the great deduction system. But mathematics, pure mathematics, is a made-up game. There's no necessary connection between the different bits.
It just shows that if you start with these numbers and do this to them, you'll end up with those numbers.
If you start with these numbers and have these set of rules and do these things to them, then this is the result and outcome.
So it's the rules for processes.
Yes, and for logics, but it's not necessarily connected to the world any more than chess is connected to the world. I can see a connection, but it's not actually built into the game. It's just a game. So that's one way of knowing.
Okay.
What else? Logical process. Then there's induction, empiricism. That is, I look at the world and I pick up things and I look at them and say, this is a cup of this kind of colour and has that kind of noise. When I put it down, it contains these. And so I draw in evidences about the real world. Now, the beauty of that is I'm now dealing with the real world, touching, feeling, sensing, hearing, smelling, the real world. The disadvantage of it is I can never actually know it's true. I never have a final, because the next hypothesis might show that what I thought before was actually untrue.
Because there's extra data. You look at all the swans you can find, they're all white. You say, all swans are white. And then a black swan swims around the bend in the river.
That's right.
The next bit of data falsifies the whole thing.
And this is wonderful, this ability to falsify and keep adapting to what we know. But
That's science.
That's science.
Yes.
Empiricism is connected with science. But of course, the two are not totally different. The science of empiricism uses the deductive systems. So maths is one of the great drivers of science. Without maths, you
mustn't
do
put
science.
These things into different pigeonholes and treat them as being very separate.
No, but you've got to understand what their differences are.
Right.
And then another way of knowing is by intuition, just by direct perception. I don't do scientific discoveries to find out that the skin is what it feels like, or the smell is what the smell is.
Or what the taste of pineapple is.
Not the taste of pineapple is. And so I use my senses and my intuitions, and we don't come into this world with a tabula rasa, with a brain that has nothing on it. We come grooved, thinking in certain ways and patterns, which allow us to take in information and retain information. So that's part of how we know.
Yep.
And then a fourth way is by relation, by revelation. I know because I'm told. You see, I don't know your middle name, Kel, and all the thinking under the sun will never guess what your middle name is.
But I could reveal it to you.
And I can't investigate it really and find out what it is.
Yes, yes.
It's only by you telling me, because that's a piece of information that is secret to you.
Yes.
Now, if you tell me what your middle name is, then I will know. But until you tell me, now in personal relationships, we know by revelation, by people revealing themselves. And the person who never says anything has no friends, because he never communicates information enough by which anybody could trust him. So, you just got no friends.
And we need to open up to reveal ourselves in order to build relationships.
Yes, yep. And in order to have trust.
Yeah. And we need to listen to what other people are revealing about themselves, and that's how
we
connect.
Now, How do we know? We know by all these methods rolled into one. It's as you reveal yourself, I am also seeing how tall you are. I am putting you in the category of human just, as opposed to some other kinds of categories.
And you're reasoning.
And I'm reasoning about it as I'm going. And I intuitively feel, and emotional intelligence is one of those very interesting areas of scientific research today, because, you know, the person who's autistic does not perceive you as I perceive you, because the emotional intelligence has been thwarted. But he would know how many hair there are on your head because he counts away, you see. And so we see differently by our intuitive makeup.
So it's the point of getting all these sources of knowledge together, not treating them as enemies, not pushing them apart.
No.
And that means that the Christian source of knowledge, which is revelation from God, God saying to us here, this is what I am like, this is what I'm doing, this is what matters, we don't discard just because it doesn't fit into this category, because we need all the categories.
That's right. And we'll be able to see that what God has revealed is reasonable in itself as a logical system and fits in with our experiences of the world.
And we can empirically see that Bethlehem exists, and, you know, et cetera,
Jesus was there at a certain point in time, and that he did die according to what the historical sources say. And the resurrection becomes then very often the crunch point, because it breaks out of what we are empirically expecting. And yet, within the Bible, it's revealed as to why it's reasonable to expect that he will.
And it all fits together, and we can see logically how it fits together. So, there you are. You think the Tonight Show with Jay Leno is fast. This is much faster television. 28 minutes dealing with a huge topic like that. But we got through a lot, didn't we?
There's a huge amount of ideas there to unpack even further in discussion, isn't there?
So think about it. Talk about it with your friends. Talk about it with your family. Talk about it in your home prayer and Bible study group.